Can you give me a cue?
Yes, thank you. All devices are recording and we are ready to start the meeting. Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the September 24, 2020 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. I'm Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Council, and I regret that I'm able to participate today only by phone due to internet issues. Despite that, I plan on having a very productive meeting. Let's start with the roll call alphabetically of council members.
This is Mike Gatto. I'm not sure if I'm first alphabetically now, but I will say that I'm here.
Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
This is Oscar Villegas, present as well.
Thanks, Oscar. I think I heard Maria.
Yes, I'm here. Maria Morani here.
And Daniel, I heard, is here.
Yes, Zingali present.
And I believe the judge will be joining us soon by phone. We have a quorum. Let's move on to agenda item three. We'll be moving into closed session, and I anticipate we'll return about 9:30. So, council members, let's move to closed session, and ATP crew will be back around 9:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello?
Councilmember Ryan. Councilmember Zingali, are you able to hear us and speak okay on the phone?
Yes, thanks. I'm here.
This is Anthony from AGP. Please stand by. We've got to get our devices rolling here. Just one moment, please.
Thank you, Anthony.
You're welcome. Just a moment. Okay, Chair, we are rolling, ready to continue.
Great, thank you. Good morning again, everyone. I'd like to reestablish the quorum, starting with Judge Damrell, if he is on now.
I don't see him called in yet, but he was calling in, so he should be on in a second.
Okay. Then let's move on to Councilmember Gatto.
I'm here.
Councilmember Maranian.
I'm here.
Councilmember Villegas.
Present.
And Councilmember Zingali.
Zingali here.
And Tatayan here. We have a quorum. Let's move on to agenda item 6, the consent calendar. Do I hear a motion to approve the summary of our previous meeting?
Gatto moves.
Motion by Councilmember Gatto.
Second.
Zingali, second.
Councilmember Maranian, second. And let's go ahead and vote, starting with Councilmember Gatto.
Gatto, I.
Maroney and I.
Tatai and I.
Zingali, I.
What is this vote on, by the way? I'm sorry, this is Judge Damrell.
Oh, no worries, Judge. We were voting on the consent calendar.
Okay, all right.
Adoption of the meeting summary.
Okay. I'll record my vote aye on the consent calendar.
Thank you. And then Councilmember Villegas.
It looks like he might have been dropped. He should be back on soon.
Brandon, I thought I heard Oscar during the quorum call.
He was on, but it looks like he might have.
Bethany, what is your advice on this vote?
Brandon, how many votes do you have recorded at this point? Or Lita, how many votes do you have recorded?
I have 5, Gatto, Marani, and Damrell, Tatayan, and Zingali.
So, Susan, it's passed. If you want to leave it open for him to vote, he can, or you can close the item because it has sufficient votes.
Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and close the item. Let's move on to agenda item 7, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and the Delta Plan. And I believe the Chief Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance, Jeff Henderson, will lead us through this item.
Yes, Chair, if I may, I'll say a few words before I hand it over to Jeff.
Okay.
So for this item, item 7, this really stems from a recommendation that came out of our Delta Plan 5-year review, where the council decided that it will develop strategies and approaches to increase outreach, engagement, and collaboration with all the agencies that are implementing our Delta Plan recommendations. Also, in our current work plan, we have a focus on implementing steps to get the state closer to reduced reliance on the Delta and to track that progress. So to that end, today, we have a panel of representatives from the Department of Water Resources and the Water Board who are going to present a high-level overview of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and its relationship to the Delta Plan. Council staff are also going to present recent analyses of the projects and actions that are described in the submitted local groundwater sustainability plans that have been prepared thus far in response to this new law. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to our Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance, Jeff Henderson. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. Good morning, council members. Don't actually have much to add to what Jessica introduced as background for this, other than the Chapter 3 of the Delta Plan, which is our chapter that concerns water supply reliability, has several recommendations that address sustainable groundwater management. And many of those recommendations would be accomplished under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, which, as Jessica mentioned, relies on a locally driven planning approach with some state oversight. And as these new groundwater sustainability agencies that you'll learn about in the presentation prepare groundwater plans and the state reviews those plans, we feel it's also important to monitor how SGMA is being implemented at the local level to help understand the implications that various projects and actions that are identified in local plans may ultimately have on the Delta. So today I'd like to welcome Taryn Ravazzini from the Department of Water Resources and Natalie Stork from the State Water Resources Control Board to the council. Taryn and Natalie will present, as Jessica mentioned, a high-level overview of SGMA and describe each of their agency's roles in the SGMA planning and implementation process. And after that, our council Sea Grant fellow Molly Williams we'll describe some recent work that we've done to review projects and actions that are described in the local plans that have been prepared to date and help to identify a range of potential implications of these actions in the future for the Delta. So with that, we'll go ahead and hand it over to Taryn. Welcome, and thank you for being with us today.
Sorry, Jeff, really quick, if I could just jump in really quick. I believe Oscar or Councilmember Villegas is called, and I just want to unmute him to make sure that this is the right phone number really quick. Hi, Councilmember Villegas, is that you that is called in of 285?
That's correct. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Okay, Taryn, please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present today to the Delta Stewardship Council. My name is Taryn Ravazzini. I'm the Deputy Director for Statewide Groundwater Management with the California Department of Water Resources. I do oversee the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act implementation on behalf of the department. It's been a while since I've been in front of the council. And so again, this is a particular personal pleasure as well to address you on this very important law and path to sustainability for California's groundwater basins. I'm afraid I think I've lost my notes with this. One moment, please. I just need to fix the video. Thank you. One of the challenges of virtual meeting. I will be presenting today with my colleague from the State Water Resources Control Board, Natalie Stork. Natalie and I have merged our presentations to, in fact, go back and forth. And so we will tag team this presentation, so to speak. Next slide. Thank you. Most importantly, I want to recognize up front that almost half of California's water supply comes roughly from groundwater in any given year, almost 40% in an average water year, and up to 60% in dry years. It's important to note as well, 85% of Californians rely on groundwater as part of their water supply. And more importantly, some communities are 100% groundwater dependent. Groundwater is used for drinking water supply, urban, commercial, and industrial use, for agricultural production, and to support our ecosystems.
But one said, she said, suppose we had been...
Thank you, excuse me. For almost 100 years, surface water has been actively managed in California. We've been capturing snowpack runoff and rainfall in lakes, rivers, and streams, and moving water through man-made canals. Sustainable groundwater management is a relatively new statewide effort to balance the use of surface water and groundwater. Next slide, please. This slide looks rather busy, but it is important to note the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is a key pivotal point for groundwater management and groundwater law and water policy overall for the state of California. The Sustainable Groundwater Management Act was chaptered into law in 2014 and became effective on January 1st, 2015. This was a critical turning point for California water. The key takeaway here, where you can see the divided line of where Sigma is there in red, is that groundwater management prior to 2015 was voluntary. And Sigma now requires groundwater management at a local level and established state regulations and enforcement backstops that my colleague Natalie and I will be talking about next. Next slide, please. I will be providing a Sigma overview. Sigma is a complex law and has many components. I do anticipate there may be some questions at the end of this presentation, but we'll try to hit on all of the high points. The first and central tenet of Sigma is local control. The law and regulations support local control and recognize that each basin in the state is unique. There's no one-size-fits-all approach for managing groundwater. We also know that's quite challenging as it relates to managing water overall. Sustainable Groundwater Management Act empowers the formation of local groundwater sustainability agencies, as we refer to as GSAs, to develop and implement groundwater sustainability plans, which we also refer to then as GSPs, that account for these local conditions. These newly established agencies are in the driver's seat. They are there to manage the basins in a manner that will achieve sustainability. It honestly cannot be said enough and was prominently acknowledged by the legislature, but the unique complexities that are the state's groundwater basins are best managed locally in order for Sigma to be successful. So as you can see here on the left-hand slide, there are a lot of entities involved in helping us all reach sustainable groundwater basin conditions. The GSAs have the lion's share of the responsibility to develop and implement those plans to sustainably manage the basin, and they have new powers and authorities to take the necessary actions. DWR has a dual role. We have a role that is regulatory, an even more significant role that is in continuing local assistance. Our regulatory role has led us to establish the regulations for how a groundwater sustainability plan must be prepared and how it will be assessed and how we will be assessing the groundwater sustainability plan's likelihood of achieving sustainability. And our assistance role, again, very important, not just for the Department of Water Resources, but there are many other state agencies that have developed and are developing tools and local assistance functions to really help the locals prepare and implement plans. This, again, is about local control, but it is really incumbent upon the state to help those local entities be successful. So we do provide a range of technical planning, and importantly, particularly at this time, financial support. The board's role is also very important here. The State Water Resource Control Board is identified in Sigma as the state backstop. And this is triggered if local management efforts fail. The board has the responsibility to temporarily step into a basin and get that basin back on track of get it back on that Sigma path. So Natalie will be, again, going into greater detail as to the board's role, but it's important to touch on here that both the board and the state, the Department of Water Resources, are jointly involved in ensuring that as representatives of the state, we are providing the greatest amount of support for locals to be successful. And in also significant in this Venn diagram is you can see the blue outline there. That is an emphasis on stakeholder engagement, developing plans for basin sustainability to really ensure our future water supply reliability. We need to have fully inclusive stakeholder engagement to really make Sigma successful. So stakeholder input really is a critical component on all levels of Sigma and plan development. The other main tenet of Sigma is sustainability. So on the right-hand side of this slide, sustainability today, it's a word that's fairly prominent in our vernacular, but there's a specific definition for what that means for groundwater under Sigma. Sigma identifies that sustainable groundwater management occurs when the six sustainability indicators or undesirable results, which are those on right-hand side, those are listed on the right-hand side of the slide, those are unavoided or eliminated. So they are determined, the plans have to show whether there are significant and unreasonable occurrence of the following things: lowering of groundwater levels, reduction of storage, seawater intrusion, degraded water quality, land subsidence, and surface water depletion. These are metrics that will be defined at the local level, and plans must be implemented in a manner that results in these six things being avoided. Next slide, please. This is an important slide coming up. There are 515 groundwater basins in California. I won't read through all of this, but you can see if you can get a closer look on your own computer, perhaps, you can see that basin boundaries do not actually line up with county lines or political boundaries. So this is another added layer, of course, to how do we address the governance around managing our basins. Basins in California are prioritized as high, medium, low, and very low priority. Those are identified here on the map. Of the 515 groundwater basins identified and defined by the Department of Water Resources, there are 94 high and medium priority basins. And those 94 are required to comply with Sigma and the Sigma requirements. Specifically, they must develop groundwater sustainability plans under the auspices of a groundwater sustainability agency and also continue with implementation. So these 94 basins account for 90% of the state's groundwater pumping. So really what we're looking at here is out of 515 basins, you know, we're about a little over 20% of where 90% of the groundwater pumping occurs. Taking that a step further, on the right-hand side, the farthest state image that you have there on the right of your screen, there are 21 groundwater basins that are additionally designated as critically overdrafted from decades of excessive pumping of groundwater. So this is an important designation between the critically overdrafted and the non-critically overdrafted basins. So the 21 critically overdrafted basins account for 62% of the state's total groundwater pumping, right? So we're looking at just 21 basins being identified as being responsible for over half of the state's groundwater that is pumped. So out of those, this is really meant to emphasize that Sigma is really intended to be precisional. It's about really emphasizing improving the conditions of the most used basins so that we can ensure their longevity for use and reliance by the people of California. So it must be noted that before Sigma went into effect, however, in January 2015, there were some basins that were actively managing and actively managing well their basins, even to sustainable levels. It's not necessarily the case for the majority of the basins. And thus, after the major drought that we had that ended in 2016, the relevance of Sigma is even greater. Next slide, please. This slide shows the steps that SGMA takes. These steps are defined. These steps define what the local GSAs are required to do under SGMA. There's been a lot of momentum built up with the early success of our first major SGMA milestone. Within the first 2.5 years, by June 2017, local agencies, the GSAs, had to be formed. All of the basins that were designated to need to comply with the regulations of plan development had to form groundwater sustainability agencies by that deadline. If that deadline was not met, if a basin was not covered by an agency, that is that would be a first opportunity for the state to really get involved and potentially intervene in the basin. By that deadline, over 99% of the basins were covered by these newly formed agencies. That is a true commitment by the locals who had to meet an aggressive schedule. That is truly a commitment by them to say that they are stepping up to the plate to actively manage their basin and to do so locally. So, again, this is showing that the SGMA is really being taken seriously by water managers. So we are now shifting into the next milestone, which is the SGMA development, the GSP development and submittal of those GSP. So the critically overdrafted basins that I was mentioning, they had a deadline to submit their plans by January 31st of 2020. So that was of this year. And so if this year wasn't challenging enough, those plans had to come in. For the critically overdrafted basins, and they have 20 years now to implement their plan, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, the remaining 70 or so basins that have to that are designated as high and medium, they have until January 31st of 2022 to submit their groundwater sustainability plans to the department. So once adopted and submitted, GSAs are given all of the authorities necessary to begin implementation of their plans with the goal of reaching sustainable conditions in a 20-year period. So by 2040 or 2042, respectively, depending on the categorization of the basin, the priority of the basin. Now, this 20-year period will allow GSAs to implement their plans, but doing so with critical adaptive management exercises. The state will be working with those local agencies in their support to support them as they develop their plan, as they begin updating their plan. One of the things about SGMA is that we have exponentially increased the amount of knowledge and information and data that we have as a state collectively around groundwater just in the last several years since the passage of SGMA. There is so much more for us to learn. So these first plans, which we do not expect them to be perfect, they are going to be adaptively managed. There are 5-year updates that the GSAs must do for those plans, resubmit those to the department. This creates a long-term relationship between the state and the local governing agencies around really improving the management of the basin and helping everyone reach sustainability. Next slide, please. Groundwater sustainability plans. So just to go over this fairly briefly, a plan must cover the entire basin, and they have to demonstrate how local sustainability goals, locally defined sustainability goals, will be achieved. And that can be achieved by, as you can see from the three pictures here, it can be achieved by a single plan where it's developed by one GSA or a single plan that's developed by multiple GSAs. So having multiple governing agencies working collectively over one plan to manage the basin. And then added complexity would be the option of multiple plans developed by multiple GSAs. Now, in that instance, of course, that many layers of complexity, you are talking about one basin. So you are really talking about the need for those GSAs and those plans to ultimately be stitched together pursuant to a coordination agreement to coordinate those plans. So it's really a comprehensive plan for the entire basin. Now, plans must convey basin information, groundwater conditions, sustainability criteria and monitoring. Most notably for the Delta Stewardship Council, it's the projects and management actions, which is the pathway to actively reach sustainability for the GSAs. And it's those projects and management actions that the local agencies are currently developing. Many of these are still conceptual, even within those plans that have been submitted to the department to date. But the GSAs will be adaptively managing to implement those projects, including project development, managing CEQA, and other permitting requirements. Upon adoption of GSPs, locals are tasked with implementing those plans over a 20-year horizon for SGMA. So where sustainability goals must be achieved, again, by 2040 or 2042, respectively. Next slide, please. This slide, if you can see it, I recognize we're trying to fit a lot on one screen, but this slide shows that 46 plans have been adopted locally. 18 basins were required to submit plans by January 31st of 2020. 43 were individual plans were submitted for the critically overdrafted basins, plus 3 additional basins submitted early as well. And so that gave us 46 plans that we're currently reviewing. There are also 9 approved alternatives to groundwater sustainability plans. And so those are allowing a total of 27 basins that currently are being actively managed under a plan of some definition, and that is working with the Department of Water Resources. Now, the legislature did require that the department review and evaluate these plans within 2 years of submittal. So we have teams of scientists, geologists, engineers from not just our headquarters, but also our 4 regional offices. They are reviewing tens of thousands of pages of these documents that have been submitted. If you can tell just from the different colors here, there are 6 basins I don't know if we can show this, but I'll identify it all the same. There are 6 basins that submitted a range of 3 to 7 GSPs per that basin. So there are 6 basins within those that have adopted plans. So those would be the ones in blue. 6 of those have multiple GSPs. And in most cases have multiple GSAs implementing those GSPs. So we're just kind of trying to share this sense of how complex this is. The next slide will be discussed by Natalie Stork. Next slide, please.
Good morning. My name is Natalie Stork. I am the unit chief for the board's groundwater management program. And the groundwater management program is responsible for the State Water Board's implementation of SGMA. So I'm here to talk to you a bit today about the State Water Board's role. Our role starts, our state intervention role starts when plans aren't submitted or plans aren't adequate or there's other triggers that start the state intervention process. So before diving into the details, I just wanted to point out 3 important things to remember about the board's state intervention role. Some people call us the backstop. The first one is that the board only steps in when local efforts fail. We can't step in whenever we'd like to. The second thing is that the board's role is to temporarily protect the basin until locals come up to speed. It's meant to not replace a GSP. And the goal is to get locals back on track and hand management of the basin back to them. And the third thing is that the backstop is primarily triggered by SGMA deadlines, which is why everyone has been very focused on deadlines coming up to 2020 and looking forward to 2022. However, it can also be triggered if DWR determines a plan to be inadequate. The state intervention role is a bit of a process. Next slide, please. All right. So first, there is an intervention trigger. So I mentioned before, plans had to be in by 2020, and the plans for the remaining share of those 94 basins need to be in by 2022. Also in 2017, we had a trigger where By June 30th, 2017, all the basins had to be covered by groundwater sustainability agencies. We had 99% compliance. It went really well, and no major actions coming out of that, which was great. So what happens when a trigger occurs? Next, the board can decide whether or not to take the basin into probation. Important thing to note is that this is an open and transparent process that culminates in a board hearing, and it's discretionary. So the board doesn't have to take a basin into probation. Then there's some time built into this process, time to fix issues at the local level. There's 6 months to 12 months to fix issues before the board moves on to the next step, which is developing an interim plan for the basin to get the basin back on track. Now I'll talk a little bit more in detail about what happens when and if and when a basin's put on probation or we do an interim plan. Next slide, please. Okay, so if a basin's put on probation, there's a few important things to know that will be going on at this time. The first thing is the State Water Board makes decisions in this probationary determination, and the board has a lot of flexibility in how it can act. Certain pumpers can be excluded from reporting requirements. There's other types of flexibility that can happen when the board decides to take a basin into probation. As I mentioned before, there's an opportunity to fix issues. This is sort of like a timeout period where the board collects the data it needs in case it needs to write its own interim plan. But this is also a chance to work out the issues that got the basin on probation in the first place. In this probationary determination, there will be the board will have an opportunity to note exactly why the basin's being put on probation. And we also have an opportunity to work with our partners at DWR and ask for their recommendations on what needs to be fixed as well. So we'll be gathering data. It's, again, an open and transparent process. There's public noticing requirements before we even get to the hearing. So there's an opportunity for locals and other interested parties to speak up and let us know what their thoughts and concerns are. Additionally, while the board is collecting data in case it needs to write its own plan, the statute is clear that the board can actually require meters on wells to make sure that we're getting accurate data so that we're able to make good decisions. All right, so if within 6 to 12 months the plan isn't fixed, the situation in the basin isn't fixed, then we move on to the next stage. Next slide, please. All right, then, so the board can begin developing an interim plan after 6 to 12 months of probation. The most important thing to note about an interim plan is that it's not meant to replace the GSP. It is a plan to get the basin back on track. The most important component of an interim plan are corrective actions. The statute lays out several options for corrective actions, one of which is demand management, which in truth is the most likely option that the board will likely use. It looks like the slides may have gone away.
Apologize for that. But, I just lost internet intermittently.
Oh, yes.
Gearing it back up really quick.
Okay. Well, I'll keep talking about interim plan. So the first thing, oh, great. It's back. Thank you. Happens to all of us with the internet going in and out. So with the corrective actions, the most likely option that the board will use is probably demand management, but the board does have other options, but demand management is probably what we're going to be relying on since it's meant to be a temporary plan to get the basin back on track. The other components of an interim plan will be monitoring to measure how the corrective actions are working, a schedule for those actions, and enforcement to ensure that the interim plan is followed. This sort of rounds out the basics of the state intervention process. The board is also, we have roles beyond state intervention, and that our main goal is for the locals to be successful. So can you move to the next slide, please? Great. Great. So I'm going to hand it off to Taryn to talk about DWR assistance and services, and I'll chime in another minute here to talk about how we're also involved with assistance.
Thanks, Natalie. So it's important to note that already the state, both the department and the state board, have supported and continue to support locals in SGMA implementation. In the interest of time, we're focusing our slides really on the financial support, but both the department and the board have various levels of support that we provide. On behalf of the department, we have and continue to provide extensive technical assistance and planning assistance. This includes the development of best management practices and guidance documents, facilitation support services, and translation services. And those are really to aid in effective stakeholder engagement. DWR has provided over $180 million in assistance since 2015, excuse me. So we also have $88 million that will be made available over the next several years from Proposition 68 for the implementation of projects for those GSPs once they are developed and adopted. And there is a commitment from this administration to expedite $26 million of that $88 million to specifically get that grant program for critically overdrafted basins up and running to support plan implementation, since many are in fact responsible now for implementing to date. Next slide, please.
Okay, so the board and DWR together have not only, you know, contributed funding to SGMA implementation, but also we've got new programs that we've rolled out. DWR has their best management practices documents. We've together worked on several documents, guidance documents, FAQs, and others to ensure and give locals a great chance at being successful at managing their basins. In addition, the board has several sources of funding that GSAs might consider for plan implementation. Here's a list of just some of the pots of funding that may be applicable to GSAs for them to consider. So while DWR holds the SGMA-specific Prop 1 funds, Prop 68 funds, the board does have some funding that's maybe applicable to GSAs. So we are together involved in doing what we can to help with success at the local level so that basins are successful and don't wind up at the state backstop. Next slide, please.
So on behalf of both Natalie and myself, on behalf of the state, we really appreciate the opportunity to speak before the Delta Stewardship Council. This is a very timely presentation. There's a lot going on. There are several different phases of SGMA happening at this time. What we have provided for you here on the screen are the two main portals for SGMA information from both of our agencies, our contact information here, if anyone needs to reach out. This is really, again, this is really a pivotal time for California Water, and it's a very challenging year right now, regardless of the water policy challenges we're all facing. So more than anything, the state is making sure that where there are concerns and issues around implementation, around engagement, how to ensure kind of as much transparency in the development and implementation of these plans are happening. Both Natalie and myself, our respective teams are available for the locals and are available for our sister agencies too, who really, we appreciate your attention to the implementation of this very important law. So thank you very much for giving us time today.
All right. Madam Chair, I believe we have a time constraint for one of our presenters. So what I might suggest if you agree, would be to go ahead and take questions for Taryn and Natalie now, and then have Molly present after that.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you, Jeff. Council members, any questions for Taryn or Natalie?
Madam Chair, this is Villegas, if I could.
Sure.
First of all, yeah, it's just an observation and then a question, I think, at the end. Ms. Terrazzini and Mr. First of all, thank you for coming. I, as the local liaison to this to the Stewardship Council, I represent the Delta Protection Commission, and I serve in that body, in that capacity, with a whole range of locals, as we call them, and supervisors and representatives from reclamation districts and the such. And I can tell you that when in 2015, when this was surfacing, there was a lot of angst, a lot of anxiety, a lot of nervousness about how this would work. I don't think many of us could have imagined in 2020, well, nobody could imagine what 2020 would look like, but let alone in the world of try to water policy and try to figure out how to manage our groundwater basins. But I just wanted to simply say, fast forwarding, from my experience and representing Yolo County, we've had very good interactions with DWR. First of all, thank you, Ms. Terrazzini, for your energy on this issue. I think it has surfaced in a very good way. You know, my staff at the county have worked very well with DWR. Obviously, we're in a unique position in Yolo County. I don't want to speak specifically about Yolo, representing multiple counties around the Delta, because I think our experiences are somewhat similar in that your staff, you and your staff, have been incredibly helpful in letting the locals figure this out, because this is a very, very difficult, complicated thing to have the water world turned upside down for you know, agricultural communities and trying to figure this thing out. We're very fortunate in our community to have had monitoring wells and not be in a critically overdrafted basin and not have the subsidence that many other areas have. So those are obviously much more complicated areas. But I will say that that both DWR and the State Water Resources Control Board have been helpful in facilitating locals figure it out, as complicated as this is. So I just am curious if my, well, I guess it's a question, if my lens or my experience is unique in thus far in Yolo County, or different than it has been from your observation throughout the state, because I interact with supervisors up and down the state on a regular basis, and I think for the most part, people have felt that DWR has been very helpful. And you know, when you hear the state's going to be involved, people get nervous for a good reason. But I think for the most part, this has been a very positive interaction, and certainly from Yolo's perspective, it has been very positive. So I'm just curious your impressions of how it's been received from other municipalities. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Villegas. I appreciate the compliments to the team who I have the privilege to lead. They are tireless and extremely passionate about this topic, and so it is. It's really my good fortune to have such a great team, and that team extends to our regional offices, which we have four regional offices throughout the state, and the department really upon Sigma's kind of birth, if you will, the regional offices have identified points of contact, individual points of contact for each basin. So the department has an individual staff person connected to as that local contact for the GSAs. So it sounds to me in particular that those points of contact have been having successful relations with the local agencies. We work very closely with our region offices to pull that very individualized kind of basin issues up to our headquarters and then work really at that broader statewide level. So I have to say the local control focus of Sigma is because the basins are so unique. And so that means with one size not fitting all, it does take a whole range of staff with exceptional skill sets to really help manage and navigate that. With that, I would say that every basin is on kind of a different trajectory. Some have, for example, more county involvement, say, for example, like Yolo County, and others just don't. The counties, you know, they just don't have the capacity or the bandwidth. And so we have been trying our best to formulate the most effective assistance that we can. And I know that goes for the state board as well, really trying to figure out how can we support all the whole range effort and governance structures that are happening at the local level to implement this. So I really appreciate your kind words. And I do believe that with the showing of the formation of the GSAs and the submittal of all the plans for critically overdrafted basins is a sign that these locals are committed to meeting SGMA's goals. And we're really, I think, working hard to help them along the way. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I apologize. I don't have the benefit of your slides. I was just notified that internet has been down here in West Sacramento and throughout Woodland and Davis. So there's something major going on. I'm not sure what that's about. But thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Council members, are there any other questions for Tara or Natalie? Well, it doesn't sound like it. Thank you so much, Tara and Natalie, for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, Madam ahead. Chair?
Is that Judge? Yes.
I do have a question, particularly applying to the applies to the critically overdrafted basins, where you have basins that are that cross over county lines. What is the nature of the autonomy, and what kind of efforts are made with local government attempting to deal with those kinds of issues, particularly in the critically overdrafted basins that cross county lines? How do you deal with that?
Certainly, Judge. Thank you. It's nice to hear your voice. And I'm happy to provide an answer. Natalie may be able to supplement that as well. As I had mentioned in my presentation, the groundwater basins and sub-basins don't necessarily follow political boundaries, right? So jurisdictions, county lines. So there are basins that do have multiple counties, perhaps, that are overlying the basin. The responsibility of the local agencies and SGMA in many respects in the law does default to the counties for governance. So groundwater sustainability agencies in many ways have county representation, but in some instances they haven't. It just depends on how the locals are choosing to kind of govern and structure. But in the instance that you have, you know, varying degrees of overlap with existing local structures or boundaries, governance boundaries, that's why the responsibility of the GSAs for coordination with the local entities, particularly with the counties, is very important. When a plan is established for a basin, we could have multiple plans for one basin. And so those have to be stitched together by a coordination agreement, which has requirements within the regulations that they have to meet for what that coordination agreement is. But it's how they are going to effectively implement jointly towards the same goals. And then additionally, what you have is the GSPs, these plans, they don't supersede any other kind of requirements that are out there. And so county general plans, this is where the GSAs and the counties really need to begin. And I can't impress on this upon this enough, really need to begin connecting to each other if they have not already, because general plans need to be taking into account the groundwater sustainability plans, and ultimately vice versa for all of this to work collectively. You have some real challenges around land use and other issues that are going to be coming up in the future with plan implementation. So I would really recommend and have been working with the counties, just presented to them last week about the significance of coordination on that point. So excellent question, Judge.
Thank you. Would the board representative like to comment on that question?
Everything I was going to say, Taryn mentioned as well. The counties have some important roles, and SGMA, these critically overdrafted basins, it can be challenging when there are multiple counties within a basin. But SGMA allows flexibility in how those GSAs could form, could cover those basins, and it left it up to the basins to figure out the governance structure within that framework that was right for them. And you know, going forward, there needs to be good coordination between counties and GSAs, especially around general plans and GSPs. We're, you know, I think there's some great opportunities there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you again, Taryn and Natalie, for taking the time to be with us today. Jeff, did, given our time constraints, are Anthony and Molly still going to present, or?
If we can entertain it, I would ask Molly to give a brief presentation on some of the work that we've done just in looking at the range of projects and management actions across the plans. But Molly, to the extent you can, I would ask you to keep it fairly brief. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And I just have a few slides here. Good morning, everyone. My name is Molly Williams, and I am the California State Sea Grant Fellow with the Planning and Performance Division here at the Council. And after getting that great primer from Taryn and Natalie about SGMA, I'm going to be walking through our review of the groundwater sustainability plans, or GSPs, which, as we've learned, were submitted by groundwater sustainability agencies earlier this year. And I'm really going to focus in on how these are relevant to the Delta and the Delta watershed and the Delta plan's water supply reliability strategies. Okay, next slide. Okay, just to set the scene here, we have a map of the legal Delta and Suisun Marsh. They're outlined in black, as well as the Delta watershed in blue and the Delta service area in green. So this really illustrates the broad extent of the flows coming in and going out of the Delta.
Right, and we both end up.
Okay, next slide, please.
Supreme Court. Do you have any regrets?
Okay, and as Taryn discussed, only a fraction of the state's 515 water basins are subject to SGMA requirements, which include the high and medium priority basins that are shown here, 94 of which are required to submit GSPs. And so as you can see from this map, there is significant overlap between the medium and high priority basins and both the Delta watershed and Delta service areas. And we care about this because, you know, as many of us know, the scale of overdraft is large in California. And the last DWR assessment estimated that between 1.1 and 2.6 million acre feet per year are overdrafted in California. And it's notable here that this estimate was conducted before the 6-year drought that started in 2011. And I believe there's a new assessment coming out, so we should get new numbers on that soon. Okay, next slide, please. And then zooming in a little bit more here, we see that there are 21 critically overdrafted basins, which Taryn touched on. And these, again, are the regions with the highest need to stop groundwater overdraft as soon as possible. And again, we see the overlap here. There are 7 that are located within the Delta watershed boundary, both either fully or partially, and 17 that are within the Delta service area where exports are going. Okay, next slide. All right, so earlier this year, the groundwater sustainability agencies from the critically overdrafted basins submitted their GSPs. And here we have a zoomed in view of the basins that's labeled. And we reviewed this first wave of GSPs that were submitted, and the second wave of other high and medium priority basins will be submitted in 2022. And these contained over 500 projects and management actions. So a lot of variety there in ideas for how to combat and achieve groundwater sustainability. And we were interested in reviewing the GSPs to understand how the plans to achieve groundwater sustainability could potentially involve increased exports from the Delta or diversions from the Delta watershed. Okay, next slide. And after reviewing the GSPs, we found that there were some common themes in the projects and actions. So by far the most prominent idea was to increase the capture and storage of flood and stormwater, or excess water as it was often referred to in the GSPs. There's also a lot of mentions of establishing or continuing water trading programs such as transfers, exchanges, imports, purchases, and marketing programs. A lot of GSAs are also interested in expanding their water recycling and treatment programs to reuse water. And there are also a lot of projects that want to improve physical infrastructure to improve efficacy of conveyance. And then in addition to that, there were demand side projects that were listed. A lot of those looked like monetary incentives for fallowing land or fees for exceeding groundwater pumping limits. And some GSPs included indirect actions such as education and outreach or closing data gaps, improving monitoring. And while we were doing this, we learned that the Public Policy Institute of California also conducted a review of the GSPs and found that the plans overwhelmingly focus on supply side strategies. And they found that the GSAs that are mostly in the San Joaquin Valley expect to reduce 80% of groundwater overdraft through supply side strategies and just 20% using demand side strategies. So we're a little, concerned here thinking about the reliance on supply side through augmentation or shifting use. Okay, and next slide. So bringing it back to relevance to the Delta, the GSPs don't specifically mention reducing reliance on the Delta. And more than a third of plans identify increasing imported water from outside of the basin. And a lot of times they didn't mention the source of this water that they would be importing. But sometimes different plans mentioned the Central Valley Project and or the State Water Project as potential sources, or it was implied. And nearly half of the plans identify stormwater capture as a potential strategy. So this is a concern for thinking about inflows into the Delta, because if basins upstream of the Delta are pulling water off of the Sacramento or San Joaquin River, this could reduce flows into the Delta. All right, and ready for our final slide here. So it's important to note that GSPs themselves are exempt from CEQA, but the individual projects and management actions that are within the plans could possibly be considered covered actions under the Delta plan. And we know that reversing groundwater overdraft is going to take, it's going to require implementation of a wide range of actions that are specific to each basin. And these GSPs are planning documents, and the GSAs have not yet begun to implement most of the projects and management actions in there. So it's kind of a menu of options that they can choose from. And, the point of this review was really just to, and of this presentation was to just bring attention to the issue of potential cumulative effects from this reliance on supply side projects that could increase demand from the Delta and the watershed. And going forward, we plan to continue to monitor and review the future GSPs that are submitted over the next 2 years and track implementation of projects that are being implemented in the basins. And we will plan to bring any future concerns to the council if they arise. All right, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes our staff presentations on this item.
I just give her 1 second. I think she's trying to unmute her phone.
Good morning. Am I still on?
You're good. We can hear you.
Thanks, Lita.
And Susan,
thank you, Molly.
Sorry, yes. Go ahead. We just concluded our presentations. Thanks.
Yes, I was on. I'm not sure why I was muted. But anyway, okay. Thank you, Molly, for your excellent presentation. Council members, are there any questions for Molly?
Madam Chair, I do have one quick question, just something she alluded to. The plans, as you said, don't currently require the reduced reliance on Delta flows specific. You mentioned the Sacramento and San Joaquin River. So is that a change, or is that something that's going to be coming as part of, or what is your, I mean, obviously it doesn't at the moment, maybe it wasn't contemplated.
Right. And, you know, Jeff, or I think Anthony is on the line here as well, can chime in. But I don't think that it's within the plans for them to, it's not a requirement for them to identify how they would reduce reliance on the Delta. That's not part of Sigma, as far as I know. So that's part of why we're bringing this concern, is that it did not seem to be a part of the GSPs in general.
Right. And I might just add to that, it's not necessarily the effect of any one groundwater sustainability plan or any set of actions that may occur within any single plan. It's really, I think, the horizon issue, if you will, that I think we're concerned about is the potential for a combination of actions that are pursued across a combination of groundwater sustainability plans, resulting in undesirable effects that are unique to the Delta in terms of, and I think the two that the staff has pointed out are the potential for affecting essentially flows coming into the Delta, as well as the potential to result in negative effects to reduced reliance as water leaves the Delta, to fulfill the needs of the variety of actions and projects that are proposed in the plans. I think that the general principle is that collectively these plans may be calling for a greater amount of water than is available from the ability of the Delta to provide that. But it's unclear at this point because, you know, specific projects are not proposed and the full set of actions that would be achieved isn't known. Because essentially, as we understand it, these plans propose essentially menus of options that individual groundwater sustainability agencies and their partners, their member agencies could pursue.
Thank you, Jeff.
Are there any other questions from council members? Okay. Lita, are there any comments from the public on this item?
Well, let me toggle over really quick and check. One second. Almost there. No public comment.
Okay. Well, then let's call it a wrap on agenda item 7. Thank you again to all our panelists and Jeff.
Thank you.
For putting together a great presentation.
Thank you.
On to agenda item 8, Chair's report. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip what I was going to report and just quickly note that council members and those interested in the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meetings, the committee will be meeting October 26th from 1 to 2:30 for its fall meeting. And with that, let's move on to agenda item 9, Executive Officer's Report.
Good morning. I'll also try to be brief here in the interest of time. I always like to start with a quick logistics reminder that in coordination with the state's efforts to combat the spread of COVID-19, most staff are working remotely at the Delta Stewardship Council, but we remain available to assist the public. Obviously, our public meetings are fully remote, but should anyone ever need to contact staff, please email hello@deltacouncil.ca.gov to be directed to the appropriate contact. And I encourage anyone interested in staying up to date on our public meetings and announcements to consistently check our website, sign up for our listserv, and that's the best way to stay updated for now. The council sent one comment letter this month to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding the Franks Tract Futures 2020 re-imaged draft. You may remember that CDFW presented this planning process to the council earlier this year. The public process explores options for improving the ecosystem, water quality, recreation, and community benefits for Franks Tract in the Delta. The comment letter we sent follows our standard template for inviting the department to engage in early consultation regarding a future covered action that may result from this effort. And on the topic of covered action certifications, as a reminder, on August 17th, the Department of Water Resources submitted a certificate of consistency for the Wings Landing Tidal Habitat Restoration Project. The public review and appeal period for the project was open from August 17th through September 16th, and no appeals were received. Therefore, the project can now move forward. I'm excited to announce that the council has three new hires. Ted Flynn joins the council as a senior environmental scientist in the Delta Science Program's Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit. Ted comes to us from DWR's Environmental Monitoring Program. He got his PhD at the University of Illinois, where he studied links between groundwater chemistry and microbial communities. And we're excited that he's going to be supporting the development of water quality synthesis, the science action agenda, and the environmental monitoring program here in his role at the science program. Geneva Hutchison is our newest information officer, and she's going to support our communications and social media efforts. Geneva completed her bachelor's in English literature at Barnard College and a master's of studies in creative writing at the University of Oxford. We're excited to welcome Geneva. And finally, Graham Padiachi joins the council as an associate government program analyst in our contracts, procurement, and business services unit supporting the Delta Science Program's fiscal tracking. So welcome to Graham. Our outreach highlights report and our active projects lists are available in your packets and on the council's website. Also, there is a legislative update included in your packet and in our board materials online. And with that, I'll quickly turn to a foreshadow of the remaining items on the agenda. We do have our lead scientist report coming up. We're very excited to have Dr. Larson here to provide her first ever report as the new Delta lead scientist. So welcome to Dr. Larson. And finally, we'll conclude with some rapid presentations from our Delta Stewardship Council fellows. We have current council fellows from California Sea Grant and the Civic Spark program, and they have the opportunity to succinctly showcase their work that they're doing at the council and talk about how it relates to the Delta plan. So we're looking forward to that. And with that, I'm happy to entertain questions. Otherwise, it concludes my executive officer's report.
All right, thank you, Jessica. Council members, any questions for Jessica?
Nope.
Nope, okay. Any public comment on this item?
No public comment.
Okay, thank you, Lita. Let's move on to agenda item 10, lead scientist report. And I'm very pleased to say that Dr. Laurel Larson is with us today to give the lead scientist report. She officially started September 1. Welcome, Dr. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan, and thank you to all of the other council members. To anyone else who might be on the line, just as a way of introduction, I am Laurel Larson, also serving as associate professor at UC Berkeley. I am now in the role of Delta lead scientist at 15% time until January 1st. I'm presently finishing a sabbatical in Finland, and I will be coming back to California sometime in December. So I'm very much looking forward to being full-time Delta lead scientist. Before I get started today, I'd like to extend my thanks to Byron Riggins, the California Sea Grant Fellow who prepared the summary materials that all of you have. And also a thanks to my predecessor, Dr. John Calloway, whose experiences have been immensely beneficial to me, and he has set a very good example for the lead scientist report. So today I'm going to be providing you with an overview of an article that recently came out in San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Sciences. And then in the second part of my report, I'll provide some information on some of the most exciting happenings in the Delta Science Program over the past month and things on our radar as we move forward. So I'll start out with the article. The article that I'm profiling is called Drought in the Drought in the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta 2012 to 2016 Environmental Review and Lessons. This was a study that was led by John Durand at the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. But two members of the Delta Science Program were also co-authors on this paper. The Delta Science Program's Yumiko Henneberry, who was a senior environmental scientist in the DSP until May 2020, was one of the co-authors. And then the Independent Science Board's Jay Lund was among the authors as well. The research was published in San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Sciences, which is funded by the Council with support from the UC Davis John Muir Institute of the Environment and the eScholarship Publishing Group. San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Sciences is unique in that it publishes research specifically about the science and resource management of the San Francisco Bay, the Delta, and upstream watersheds. And this scope allows managers and stakeholders in these areas to have access to high quality, geographically specific science to inform their management needs. This paper also ties into a report that John Calloway gave back in, I believe it was July, when he highlighted an article published in Science magazine on mega drought in the American Southwest. As a reminder, in that article, the tree ring analysis conducted by the authors revealed that since the year 2000, the American Southwest has experienced drier conditions than any other 20-year period since the year 1800, with one exception of a late 1500s mega drought. So set within the context of that regional long-term drying, as you well know, California experienced a severe drought from 2012 to 2016, which prompted the governor to declare a state of emergency. And it's that drought which is the focus of this article. So the authors of this paper conducted a review of environmental management and, interestingly, the use of science in that management during this drought. Their review was based on a number of available reports and syntheses. It was based on available data, and it was also guided by discussions with 27 agency staff, stakeholders, and researchers. So in terms of the conditions of this drought, the years 2012 to 2016 experienced below average precipitation, but not extraordinary low precipitation given the historical record. What was extraordinary about this drought period and made the drought so severe is that this somewhat low precipitation was coupled with extraordinarily hot temperatures. And this created a set of unique management challenges that the paper goes into. The paper was focused on key management actions that were in turn focused on four major drought water management priorities as stated by the water managers. One of those was to support public health and safety. The second was to control saltwater intrusion. The third was to preserve cold water in the Shasta Reservoir, which is essential for releases that sustain Chinook salmon, particularly winter run Chinook salmon. And the fourth was to maintain at least a minimum level of protection for state and federal endangered species within the Delta. It's interesting that these four sets of management priorities are a really nice embodiment of what it means to manage the Delta for co-equal goals of providing a reliable water supply for California and protecting the Delta ecosystem. So getting into the meat of the paper was really focused on lessons learned and insights gained during this period of extremely challenging management of the Delta. The authors pointed out that drought management in particular is particularly tricky because sometimes the four goals that I just highlighted come into direct conflict with each other. One example is the need for salinity control within the Delta through water releases from upstream, which could conflict with the need to preserve cold water in the Shasta Reservoir for releases timed with winter run Chinook salmon. This was a particularly difficult management objective during the 2012 to 2016 drought because these challenges were really exacerbated by the warmer temperatures experienced during this period of time. And despite managers' best efforts, 95% of larval winter run Chinook salmon were decimated in 2014, a particularly hot year. But there were also some success stories that the paper highlighted. One is to minimize the need for reservoir releases to maintain freshwater inflow to the delta, a temporary salinity barrier was installed on the False River. According to the authors, this project was one of the best examples of science-informed management, not just during the drought period, but in recent history. Scientists were able to quickly mobilize to conduct baseline surveys of salinity, water quality in general, food web dynamics, and invasive clam distribution prior to installation of the barrier. And having this baseline then enabled them to specifically attribute changes in salinity and species abundance and species dynamics to the installation of the dam in a statistically robust manner. And their studies also showed that this barrier was quite effective at mitigating salinity and detrimental ecological change. So this is a great example of how science can respond to rapidly changing conditions and inform management strategies, but it does require resources. And so the authors talk about some of the resources that might be needed in order to enable future rapid responses to drought or other extreme conditions within the Delta. One important set of resources is funding resources. They recommend that funds be made available to enable scientific studies and management activities in response to drought conditions, similar to funds available to respond to other extreme events such as earthquakes and floods. They claim that drought-based studies are relatively rare, often because the drought is nearly over by the time the opportunity to conduct this research is recognized. So one example of this is that enhanced monitoring of Delta smelt through the Delta smelt resiliency strategy began in the last year of the drought, after it was already recognized that the species was spiraling towards extinction as a result of conditions during the drought. They recommend that on the management side, there should also be dedicated drought response funds in order to support the development of interagency plans, implement regular drought exercises similar to earthquake exercises or flood exercises, and establish emergency authority mechanisms. So in addition to funding resources, another set of resources that enable science to work most effectively with management during these extreme conditions is data resources. The authors point out that during interdrought conditions, science priorities naturally shift to other things. And so agencies do not invest in the type of monitoring that is needed to establish a baseline from which drought effects can be assessed in a statistically robust manner. One example of this is that, or one example that they highlighted is that many long-term monitoring records in the Delta have gaps at critical times, which usually are just before the next drought. And so there's a challenge of knowing what that baseline is from which assessments of drought impacts can be made. So our monitoring resources need to be prepared for the next drought. The authors place needed emphasis on the long-term nature of this monitoring. Much of our understanding of the effects of management actions comes from long-term continuous surveys. So one example of this that was highlighted in the paper is that it is the example of an ecosystem-wide study of the Montezuma salinity control gates reoperation, which this study was conducted after the drought had finished, and it relied on long-term survey data in order to compare fish and water quality response within and between drought years. Some other effects do require monitoring across several droughts in order to draw management relevant conclusions. Some studies that took place during the 2012 to 2016 drought were inconclusive on how the drought impacted specific environmental processes within the Delta. One example of this is research that was done on the response of harmful algal blooms, particularly Microcystis blooms, to drought conditions. basically that study was, it pointed to a likely impact of the higher temperatures during the drought, but was not statistically robust. And so the authors were saying that intensive monitoring through the interdrought period and into the next drought could provide the weight of evidence needed in order to make statistically robust statements about whether drought conditions do increase the incidence of harmful algal blooms and by how much. Recommendations from this article provide a path forward that is very much in line with the science needs highlighted in the Independent Science Board's manuscript on preparing for and accelerating uncertain environmental, preparing for accelerating an uncertain environmental change. This is a manuscript that calls for new approaches to doing science in a rapidly changing world that requires both the anticipation of short and long-term change, as well as mechanisms for understanding and responding to these rapid change processes, such as pelagic organism decline or rapid decline in delta smelt before those processes are complete. So another important success story highlighted in the article is the importance of interagency collaborative teams that can resolve management conflicts through careful consideration of trade-offs and assemble interdisciplinary teams of experts to resolve scientific uncertainties. So the Interagency Ecological Program, or IEP, is one good example of an interagency collaborative scientific team that can collectively address a wide range of scientific uncertainties associated with the drought. The IEP is an association of state and federal agencies who have collaborated to provide timely, highly specialized ecological data for management of the Bay Delta system since the 1970s. So I'll conclude this part of the report and this article summary by summarizing a few of the other key insights and recommendations that are relevant to the council. One key insight is that a state declaration of pre-drought conditions would allow scientists and managers to potentially better prepare for worsening conditions. Other recommendations include improved transparency and documentation of institutional drought knowledge, the development of a drought management plan, and the need to rebuild vulnerable fish and wildlife populations during anti-drought or non-drought periods to promote ecosystem resilience. And this might involve operations of salmon fish hatcheries during those non-drought periods in order to restore runs that were previously almost decimated. All of these recommendations urge consideration of the influence of climate change. This study was relevant to Chapter 3 of the Delta Plan, which addresses a more reliable water supply by highlighting the need to increase water conservation and improve water management information as a core strategy to achieve the co-equal goals. And this study also shows the value of capitalizing on existing data through increasing science synthesis as well, which is an action identified in the 2016 to 2021 science agenda. So before I move on to a recap of previous Delta Science Program activities and a look ahead, I'd like to pause and ask if there are any questions from members of the council on any aspects of this study.
Madam Chair, this is Oscar.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Oscar.
Hi there, Dr. Larson, thank you very much and welcome. It's not necessarily a question, but it's just a comment. Thank you very much for surfacing this article. I know it came out of the University of Arizona kind of at the beginning of the year, and I had asked some questions about it previously, and I'm really happy that you are spending time and sort of surfacing kind of the essence of the article and some of the recommendations. And I think it's incredibly important to underscore what you just said, in my opinion, and that is the notion of, I'm not sure about, you know, declarations, but certainly going through a series of exercises that are critically important for all of us to undertake in pre-drought years so that we're prepared, because we seem to have a short memory when we are in a drought. It is crisis time, but when we're not, we sort of revert back to the normal ways of conducting day-to-day business. And so I think that one, for me at least, as a local elected official trying to figure out how to manage what seems to be unmanageable, is critically, critically important. And so I would love to continue to have this conversation in terms of finding ways to go through, just like we would with, you know, exercises and anything other or any other sort of large
challenging issues such as earthquakes, where we constantly are going through exercises. I just think that we've lost, there's not been sufficient leadership in that role until the crisis is upon us. And at that point, everybody's scrambling to try to figure out what to do. So thank you very much for surfacing this issue in the article.
Thank you for that comment. And one of the points that the authors made is that droughts like the 2012 to 2016 drought are likely to continue in the future. This is what the climate models are projecting. And these droughts are likely to be similarly accompanied by the warm temperatures that made management of this drought particularly challenging. And so there are efficiencies to be gained by having the institutional and science governance structures in place already to respond to those drought conditions even before they occur. Are there any other questions before I move on? Okay, if not, then I'm happy to communicate offline about any questions that might come up. I'll move on to the next part of the report now, which is a recap of recent Delta Science Program activities and a look ahead. And I'll start out by talking about an activity that everyone in the Delta Science Program was incredibly excited about, which happened between September 8th and September 10th. This was the Sacramento River Drainage Spring Run Chinook Salmon Workshop. This was a workshop that the Delta Science Program put on in coordination with the Department of Water Resources and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. It was a three-day workshop that was attended by over 200 subject matter experts and generated a lot of excitement, not just in the program, but in many other agencies as well. The goal of the workshop was to assess the state of the science needed to generate spring run Chinook salmon population estimates and identify knowledge and monitoring gaps that might exist prior to generation of these estimates. These population estimates are needed in order to inform management of the state water project. The first day of the three-day workshop consisted of expert presentations that were topically focused and question and answer sessions, which provided fodder for breakout session discussions on the second day. The third and final day included a recap of the outcomes of the breakout sessions, a workshop synthesis, and an outlining of next steps by the Department of Water Resources lead scientist, Ted Sommer, and also the Delta Stewardship Council's Deputy Executive Officer for Science, Louise Conrad. And there was also a general discussion that occurred on that third day. One of the interesting things about this workshop is that it really provides a model for future workshops organized by the Delta Science Program, such as the Steelhead Science and Monitoring Workshop, which is now being planned for February of 2021. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has requested that workshop in order to help them comply with mandates under the biological opinion for the Central Valley Project. And so the lessons learned from the Chinook Spring Run Salmon Workshop will certainly inform the planning of the February Steelhead Workshop. Any questions on that before I move on to items on your radar? Okay, I'll move on to the final part of this report, in which I highlight a few items coming up in the next few months. And these are also in your summary sheet prepared by Byron. The first thing is that the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda Delta Management Questions Workshop is coming up very quickly on September 29th. The Delta Science Program is hosting a workshop to discuss and refine the top Delta management questions that were received as part of the process to update the Science Action Agenda. So members of the Delta Science Program reached out to a wide range of water managers and stakeholders, asking them to contribute management questions that were top priorities for them for the coming years. We received 1,181 questions. And so this workshop is needed to really go through and refine those questions, merge them into themes, and work towards developing the priority actions that will be highlighted in the 2022 to 2026 Science Action Agenda. We're all very much looking forward to that workshop. Complementary to the Science Action Agenda Delta Management Questions Workshop is the Science Needs Assessment Workshop, which is coming up on October 5th to 6th. The Science Action Agenda focuses on short-term management needs within the Delta, whereas the Science Needs Assessment Workshop focuses on the science needed to underpin long-term management needs decades out, for example. The Science Needs Assessment Workshop came about as a result of recommendations by the Independent Science Board to consider long-term climate change in a more regimented way in our planning. And so on October 5th to 6th, the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee, or DPIC, and the Delta Independent Science Board are going to host a two-day virtual workshop that focuses on identifying what these long-term science needs are. This workshop is something you've heard about already from John on multiple occasions. It was originally planned for the spring, but had been delayed to October as a result of COVID-19 and is still going to be held in a virtual format. The workshop will consider physical, chemical, biological, and human processes, as well as the infrastructure needed to integrate and support efforts for developing a bolder and more forward-looking Delta science strategy. And this takes a step forwards towards fulfilling the Delta Independent Science Board in 2019 Delta Science Plan's call for anticipatory science that considers long-term change. So one other symposium that is being planned for October is the Zooplankton Ecology Symposium, which will take place on October 27th to 28th. This, again, is a virtual symposium. It's going to feature the latest research on zooplankton ecology and monitoring. It will take place over two consecutive half days that will consist of talks and panel discussions focusing on the San Francisco estuary, as well as the larger Delta system. The primary audience for this symposium is scientists and will include content on zooplankton biology and ecology, monitoring programs, data collection methods, in the IEP's integrated zooplankton data set. So keep that on your radar. And then the final set of meetings or workshops that I would like to highlight are the ongoing 2020 Interagency Ecological Program virtual workshop. I know John talked about that in his last lead scientist report. There are still sessions going on to highlight specific topics. And the technical sessions that are coming up are a September 24th session focused on the Sassoon Marsh, called One Sassoon Marsh, a Wildlife Balancing Act. And then on September 29th, the topic of the virtual sessions will be scientific communication, messaging beyond the ivory tower. And that will be moderated by senior environmental scientist Lynn Takata of the Delta Stewardship Council. On October 8th is a session that's also focused on Sassoon Marsh, specifically on aquatic terrestrial linkages and restoration. And then on October 13th is the plenary session that will be moderated by the IEP lead scientist, Steve Culbertson. He is also presenting on monitoring scientifically and thinking ecologically from 9:55 to 10:15 a.m. on that day. And there's information on how to connect to that workshop in the summary materials that Byron prepared to you. So finally, I'd like to mention an exciting new science communication platform that is funded by the Delta Science Program. Maven's Notebook has partnered with the Estuary News Service to produce a podcast featuring scientists doing science in the estuary. The purpose of this podcast is to provide airspace to scientists so that they could highlight what they're doing and how their work is relevant to management. On Monday, the first podcast will be released and will feature David Ayers. David is a current Delta Science Fellow and also a PhD student at UC Davis, where he's studying predator-prey interactions and the environmental factors that shape those interactions. So I encourage you to look at the Council's social media on Monday to find the link to the podcast. This is not something that is in your summary materials, so do make note of that if that is something that's of interest. And it's something that we're all very excited about within the science program. So are there any questions on upcoming activities before I move to the by the numbers portion of this report? Okay, if there's no questions, I'll keep the final section of this report very brief because I know time is pressing today. Byron has prepared the typical by-the-numbers summary as one of the appendices in your written materials. And I'm not going to go into that in detail, but basically what the numbers are telling us is that precipitation in the northern and central Sierra is low for this time of year, about 61% of average. Despite that, the Sacramento River has nearly average flow, but the San Joaquin River flows are quite low, running only at about 30% of their 20-year flow average. Water temperature is fairly variable, but is comparable to averages within 5% or so. And Shasta and Oroville reservoirs are at 81% and 75% of their average storage, whereas the San Luis reservoir is at 106% of its and 106% of its average storage. So with that, I will conclude the report, and I look forward to the one-on-one meetings I have with many of the council members coming up over the next few weeks, and I look forward to working with all of you over the next few years.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Laurel. Are there, Lita, are there any public comments on this item?
There are no public comments for this item.
Okay. Council members, if you have, do you have any other questions for Laurel?
I would just simply say welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation.
Yeah, welcome and interesting presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Laurel. We'll move on to agenda item 11. Delta Stewardship Council Fellows presentations. I think Annie's going to do, Annie Merritt will give the introduction to this item. Is that correct?
I can reintroduce the item. As I mentioned earlier, this is really an opportunity for the fellows, the current cohort that we have right now at the Delta Stewardship Council, to present to you and to our broader audience on what they're working on and on how it's important to the Delta plan and the execution of the council's work plan. So you may know that we host a variety of different types of fellows each year. Sometimes they're from the Capital Fellows programs, sometimes Civic Spark, and usually Sea Grant fellows. And so we've got a mix of those here today, and we're just going to go right into their brief presentation. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and get started. Thank you, everyone. So yeah, I'm Annie Merritt. I'm a Civic Spark Climate Fellow in the Planning and Performance Division of the Council. Next slide, please. So today I wanted to talk about two major tasks that I've been working on during my time with the Council. So first, I've been supporting some outreach with community-based organizations as part of the Delta Adapts initiative, which is the council's climate change adaptation or climate change vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy initiative. And then I'll talk a little bit about the climate change vulnerability assessment that I'm preparing for the city of West Sacramento. Next slide. Yeah, so other council staff and I have been doing some initial outreach with community-based organizations and service providers throughout the Delta and Sassoon Marsh. And we've really been trying to reach out to CBOs that represent vulnerable communities in the Delta region. So the goal of this outreach is really to establish relationships with these organizations and to start a dialogue between the council and these organizations and to hear more about the ways in which the communities that they serve are vulnerable to climate change. And we also wanted some input on the best way that the council can undertake equitable and inclusive public outreach activities. So we, all in all so far, we have reached out to over 40 community-based organizations and service providers. And then we've had the chance to talk to about 15 of these organizations. We've gotten some really good feedback from them so far. And we've really tried to reach out to a wide array of organizations representing the diverse communities throughout the Delta. Next slide, please. Yeah, so we've received some really valuable feedback from our conversations with these organizations. So I'll just touch on a few of those right now. So for example, we heard a lot about the issue of meeting fatigue with community members, that community members are kind of saturated with existing community events that are already going on. And this, of course, is kind of exacerbated with coronavirus when everyone has a little bit less capacity. So we were encouraged to piggyback on existing community events and initiatives where possible. And then we were also encouraged to work with these CBOs to create these public outreach activities, you know, because they're the ones that have trust in their communities and already have those relationships. And then another important piece of feedback was just in terms of messaging for Delta Adapts, that when we talk about climate impacts, we were encouraged to really talk about how climate change will directly impact people and their lives. So to not just talk about how climate change will impact the physical Delta, because a lot of times that might not be what community members care about or, yeah. So next slide, please. Yeah, so then the next item I wanted to talk about, the climate change vulnerability assessment that I am creating for the city of West Sacramento. This is part of my Civic Spark project work that supports a local government beneficiary. So for this project, I am taking results from the Delta Adapts vulnerability assessment and providing the city of West Sacramento with some more specific information on vulnerability to several climate change hazards. So first of all, I'll take a little step back to explain that vulnerability is typically thought of as the intersection of exposure to climate hazards, high sensitivity to those hazards, and low adaptive capacity, which is the ability to respond and recover from those hazards. So as part of this work, I created a so-called social vulnerability index designed to identify city communities that have highest sensitivity and lowest adaptive capacity to climate impacts. And this index is really modeled after a similar index created for Delta Adapts. So I just replicated that methodology to create an index for the city. Next slide, please. Yeah, so this index was created using 14 underlying indicators, socioeconomic and health indicators, at the census tract and the block group scale. And some of these indicators included linguistic isolation, housing tenure, race, vehicle access, among others. So here are my results for the city. So the darker red, pink colors mean higher social vulnerability. So as you can see, this vulnerability was really concentrated in the northern portions of the city, north of the freeway. So just to explain kind of why I'm doing this. So next steps are to overlay this information with actual climate hazard exposure data. So for example, I will overlay the council's flood model results. The council is modeling flood impacts in the future with climate change. So I can overlay those results onto this index in order to determine the areas of the city that are the most vulnerable to future flooding. Really, the point of this is to identify vulnerabilities so that adaptation strategies can be created that address those specific vulnerabilities. So just for example, you might want to identify areas of the city most vulnerable to extreme heat so that you know which areas to prioritize and to create programs and projects that mitigate heat in those areas. And next slide, please. But that's it. So thank you so much. And I will let our next speaker, Byron Riggins, take it away. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Annie. As she said, I'm State Fellow Byron Riggins, and I'm pleased to be here today. Next slide, please. So my name is Byron Riggins. I'm the State Sea Grant State Fellow in the Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit of the Delta Science Program. I'm a native Philadelphian, but my adventures around the unique Delta landscape make me increasingly feel like a Californian. I have a Bachelor's of Science in Marine Sciences from the University of Delaware, and I'm a soon-to-be recipient of a Master's of Science in Interdisciplinary Marine and Estuarine Sciences at San Francisco State University's Estuary and Ocean Science Center. While there, I investigated the ecological structure and function of a local seaweed called rockweed, which is threatened by urbanization and climate change-induced sea level rise. While here at the Council, I have lent my support to some efforts, and I'm also led on some. As you've just heard from lead scientist Dr. Laurel Larson, I am responsible for the production of the lead scientist report. The lead scientist report is a monthly update to the Delta Council on the state of critical Delta water resources, such as snow caps and reservoirs, but also the state of current Delta science. This project has challenged me to hone my skills of science synthesis and also increase fundamental understanding of the Delta system. Next slide, please. So here's a conceptual model that I developed for the June lead scientist report. This model was adapted from Williams et al. 2020, an article entitled "Anthropogenic Warming Largely Contributes to an Emerging North American Mega Drought." Basically, in this study, what the researchers did was they used tree rings to reconstruct soil moisture anomalies since 800 BC. And if you'll notice, the areas shaded in red represent dry periods or drought periods, whilst the areas shaded in blue represent wet periods. What's key to note here is that these drought periods were largely influenced by anthropogenic activities. And if you can see at the bottom there, that yellow ring represents the driest period on record. The period from 2000 to 2018 represents the second driest period on record due to analysis of the tree rings. And yes, it represents the second driest period on record since 800. Next slide, please. So with the help of my unit, I also charted the Delta Diversity Team. This represents a new effort, and the mission of the team is to increase internal cultural sensitivity, but also equity and representation as it relates to our independent scientific review panel. The team meets once a month to discuss contentious social issues and look for ways to tangibly support organizations whose missions align with that of our own. With the help of the science program's senior environmental scientist, Lynn Takata, I recently produced a short informational video for National Estuaries Week. This video showcases my master's research and also highlights the importance of estuaries. This video also promotes the idea of one estuary, one science, which basically requires that any effort to understand the Bay Delta system gives great consideration to its interconnected nature. This project has challenged me to practice my science communication in a medium that is somewhat unfamiliar to me and has also increased exposure of the CSPR unit and the Council to the larger Delta science enterprise. Next slide, please. So during my fellowship, I've also been working on a personal project. This personal project represents a review and it explores the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act as it relates to non-critically overdrafted basins and their potential implications for the Delta. Now, non-critically overdrafted basins are not required to submit their official groundwater sustainability plans until 2022. Thus, my efforts so far have been monitoring developments in anticipation of this critical 2022 deadline. With the help of my unit, I also help support updates to the 2022-2026 Science Action Agenda. The Science Action Agenda is a cornerstone document of the Delta Science Strategy, and it prioritizes and aligns science actions to inform management decisions and receives updates every 4 years. My efforts here have exposed me to the breadth and depth of management challenges and needs within the Delta and the complex nature of collaborative science. My experiences as a fellow have urged me to develop rapidly as an environmental steward, and I've been pleased to do so in an environment that feels just as connected as the systems we protect. Thank you. Now, I would like you all to join me in welcoming our next Sea Grant State Fellow, Cheryl Patel, to present on her experiences thus far within her fellowship.
Thank you, Byron. Hi, good morning. My name is Cheryl Patel. I am the California Sea Grant Fellow that is working with the Science-Based Adaptive Management Unit. And I wanted to thank you for giving me some space during this meeting to give you an update on some of the work I've been doing during my fellowship. So I come from a strong background of aquatic ecology my master's thesis research. It focuses on lower food web dynamics, so I would look at zooplankton and phytoplankton interactions. And so because of this, when I came into the fellowship, I was very interested in participating with the zooplankton synthesis working group. And they have done a really great job of creating this really helpful open access integrated data set that pulls together zooplankton monitoring information from across different programs and puts it into this one place for people to use. And as Dr. Larson mentioned earlier, something we're putting together is a symposium that's happening later this fall. And so that's going to be a really great place for our group members to showcase what they have used, how they've used this data set to do analysis and learn more about the zooplankton ecology and biology in our system. And we also have speakers who are coming from all over California and across the country. So we're trying to create a space where we can connect and learn more about zooplankton research in our system, but also learn about zooplankton in other systems. So next slide, please. Oh, I missed that cue earlier. So next slide again, thank you. So half of my time for my fellowship is spent supporting the adaptive management work in my unit, but the other half of the time I am using to support the Delta Independent Science Board. And one of the major projects that they have going on right now is the monitoring enterprise review. And so I've had an opportunity to help with that review. And that's really looking at all of the different monitoring that we know is going on in the Delta, but gaining more information about how it's helping meet our needs for the science we need to do. So one of the things that this review has done and is put out a questionnaire to ask folks that work in the system about the monitoring that they use. And so these responses from the questionnaire, they were funneled to me, and I had the opportunity to analyze those responses and hopefully help inform the review further. So the things we want to look for are, what are the gaps in our monitoring? What redundancies exist? And overall, where and how can we really improve the Delta's monitoring enterprise overall? Next slide, please. Thank you. And then another major effort that's being done by the Delta Independent Science Board in collaboration with DPIC is our Science Needs Assessment Workshop, which, thank you, Dr. Larson, also gave you a nice update on. That's also coming up. And so I've had an opportunity to be a part of the project management team, and we were working really hard with our planning team to design this workshop that really gives the participants a chance to provide a meaningful input to the assessment overall, so we can really hone in on how we can build a long-term science strategy and really address those rapid environmental changes that are coming upon us with climate change. So like she said earlier, the workshop was originally planned for April, but it has been restructured to be a virtual event and happening in October. But between that time, we wanted to keep people engaged with this assessment. So I helped to organize our four-part discussion seminar series, which you might have heard of. And during these seminars, we put together panels and invited speakers to really help begin our discussions about the science needs in our system. And we will be using those that information and really carrying it into the workshop to expand on them for the overall assessment. Next slide, please. Thank you. And something that's more of a recent project that's been on my plate is a restoration synthesis that's being led by Dylan Chappell, who's also in my unit. So this is really a synthesis of the restoration that's being done across the Delta. And Dylan, he knew that I had experience and interest in food web ecology. So he gave me this great opportunity to lead this whole section in the synthesis. So I'm going to be looking at how our food webs in our system impacted by the restoration that's being done. So that if there are any lessons that can be learned from our project so far, they can be applied to future restoration projects. And this effort is really timely because the topic of restoration projects really aligns with some topics that will be covered in our upcoming adaptive management forum that's happening in early January 2021. So it will be great to see how our efforts right now will play into and learn from what we gain from that forum as well. So far, contributing to all these projects and efforts has been a really valuable experience, and I'm really, really looking forward to each of them inching closer or to completion or into their next phase. So I want to thank you for your time this morning and introduce Molly Williams, who's coming up next.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks, Cheryl, for the handoff. I'm going to make this quick and just talk about some of the projects that I've worked on this year, just on this one slide. So I am the California State Sea Grant Fellow in the Planning and Performance Division, and the majority of my time this year has been devoted to working on the Delta Adapts Initiative, and specifically the climate change vulnerability assessment that's currently underway. So just a couple examples of different ways I've contributed to this project have been through analyzing seasonal shifts in storm surge events under different climate scenarios in R. And I worked for a while on the water supply technical memo with some of our colleagues over at DWR on analyzing the sensitivity of the water supply system in California. And I also got to work on the flood hazard technical memo through supporting with GIS to create flood hazard layers. And one of the coolest things I've been working on that I'm the most excited about that we're going to put out publicly soon is this Shiny app that you can see a screenshot of on the right, which is an application through R, which is a statistical analysis software that allows you to interact with data and play around with it. And so what you see here at the right is the social vulnerability index data that Annie was talking about in her presentation, displayed spatially and in terms of vulnerability of different census blocks throughout the Delta. So this map is going to be usable by us, by our collaborators, by community members to visualize social vulnerability to climate change in the Delta in a lot of different ways. And also for potential project applicants to place location pins on here and see where specifically their projects lie in terms of environmental hazards and social vulnerability. So that's been really fun to be working on. And so that's kind of the quantitative side of the work that I've been doing. And then in addition to that, I've gotten to delve into doing regulatory review, which has been really fun and interesting. So I've gotten to draft some comment letters on environmental impact reports, did the groundwater sustainability review, as I was talking about earlier, also gotten to review CEQA documentation for various projects across the state to determine whether they're relevant to our work here. And then finally, I was working with Avery and the rest of our department earlier this year on amending the chapter 4, the ecosystem chapter of the Delta Plan, which was also a fabulous experience. So yeah, I've gotten to do so many different things, and it's been a fabulous year, and we've got a couple more months to go. So thank you.
Well, thank you to all of you for these short, concise, and informative presentations. I just want to say that the Delta Stewardship Council has this tradition of encouraging and hiring fellows. And from my time on the council, I've observed that the fellows produce high quality work that really furthers the council's Delta Science program and the council's efforts to encourage science-based informed decision-making in the Delta. And it's wonderful to have these early career scientists working with our more seasoned veterans on Stewardship Council staff. It's terrific to see the work that is produced. Council members, are there any questions for any of our fellows?
Madam Chair, it's not a question. It's just thank you very much. I love, Jessica and I have talked about this. I love the energy of young fellows coming, fellows coming through the pipeline and getting excited about the science and the work that we're doing and the agendas that we have before us. So it's incredibly important, and I love the energy, so thank you.
Yes, thanks, Oscar. Well, if there aren't any questions from council members, is there any public comment on this item?
Sorry, no public comment on this item.
Okay, thank you, Lita. Any public comment in general? We'll move on to agenda item 12, public comment in general.
I don't see any additional public comments.
Okay. Well, then we'll wrap up the meeting. Next council meeting is scheduled for October 22, 2020, via teleconference. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to be with us today. Stay safe and healthy, and see you next time.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.